there's a lot to be said for waiting. When I was at school, we read a play called Waiting for Godot. It's a very famous modern play. And the whole action of it consisted of just waiting around for something to happen. The kind of the nature of what was going to happen was not ever really made clear. And so you never really knew if it happened or not. But sometimes it's just that that act of not doing or not expecting or just being with time as it sort of winds its own course. Pushing it without holding back, just being with the the flow of things. And of course the nice little pun in the play Waiting for Godot, you never knew who Godot was. So you're always waiting for Godot, but you just don't know who they're waiting for. And of course the kind of the pun is that Godot sounds like God. So you're waiting for God, but you never really know who God is or if he's there at all, or if he is there, if he's coming. And if he's coming, then has he arrived already and haven't recognized him? So practicing Dhamma is a little bit like that too, because you're waiting for Dhamma. And sometimes you're never quite sure what you're waiting for. Can you switch the lights on, please? It's making this buzzing noise. Thank you. Sorry, that buzzing noise was just testing my equanimity. So we're waiting, are we not quite sure what we're waiting for? Because we don't know what we're waiting for, we don't know when it arrives. I think this is, there's something quite important about that. And there's something in us that always wants to go seeking. We have this idea that the seeker, one's seeking for this and seeking for that. And there's an interesting teaching in the suttas somewhere where it talks about the different kinds of search. And I think there's three kinds of search, if I remember rightly, is the kamesana, bhavesana, and brahmacharyesana. I may have got those wrong. But the kamesana is the search for sensual pleasures. Seeking to find happiness and satisfaction in the latest computer operating system or whatever, these kinds of things. The hale sought now is the search for some kind of, almost like some kind of home. Searching to sort of find some home where you can be and be comfortable and be safe. Yes, that's a really kind of primal urge, isn't it? You imagine like what it's like as an animal or something like that. You know, you have a very rudimentary home. Sometimes the animals will just have a feeling of a space, a certain particular area which is their home, their kind of domain. In other cases, they wouldn't. Like, imagine if you're a fish or something like that, or a dolphin. And where do you have your home? You're just kind of drifting around. You don't know what's going to drift into you, literally. Drifting around the whole ocean. So we want some kind of stability. You can imagine for the ancient cavemen, cavewomen, that finding a nice cave to go and stay in. That home. Feeling of shelter. Feeling that, well, you know, maybe there is going to be a howling, ravenous, saber-toothed tiger that's going to come in at the entrance to the cave, but at least it's not going to come up behind me. At least that bit's safe. And so you don't appreciate that until you've tried homelessness. And that's always a good thing to try, is just not having a home, just wandering around and sleeping in the parks or the side of the road and see what happens. And then you appreciate it, you know. What's it actually like to be able to just feel comfortable, feel safe, protected. And the bhavesana is really that kind of feeling, but that's extended in like a cosmic or a final sense. It's the idea that it's basically the delusion that we can find a permanent safe home. Getting reborn somewhere where we can stay there forever and be nice and happy and comfortable and cozy. The last one of those kinds of searches, the interesting one, is the brahmacharyasana, is the search for a holy life. And these three things should all be abandoned. So the search for a holy life is something that should be abandoned. It's quite interesting why that is put in there with these other two things. And so this is this kind of restlessness. Perhaps this is related to, I'm not sure, but perhaps this might be related to the Uddhaja of the anagami, the non-returner, still has this subtle restlessness, Uddhaja. And perhaps that's maybe not the same thing, but somehow it's this idea of, well, I've got to find the answer somewhere. You know, I've got to find the right monk, I've got to find the right monastery, I've got to find the right meditation technique, and so on and so forth. And of course you can see many people do this for their whole lives, and even monks. You know, recently had the news of a monk as a friend of ours who's been ordained for I don't know how long, 30 something years, and he's been on this brahmacharyasana the whole time, of going here, going there, looking for this teacher, looking for that teacher, and he's got this exhaustive encyclopedic knowledge of all the teachers and their meditation techniques, and probably knows more about different teachers and their meditation techniques than anybody else in the world, I would imagine. And we recently heard news that he's disrobed. So he's still looking, he's still searching, and hasn't been able to abandon this brahmacharyasana. So one of the characteristics of faith is that there's a certain a certain stickiness to it, a certain contentness to it. It comes with decision. One sets one's mind on a particular goal, a particular practice, a particular way of living, and steps out into a commitment to that. And that requires some doing, doesn't it? Because if you're not really sure what you're doing, you can make bad mistakes. And a lot of people do. And there's a lot of rubbish out there in the spiritual world. And it's a lot of people who get involved in very kooky cults and things that are just a bit dumb or limited and all of these kinds of things. A lot. Whole religions full of them. I won't say which religions, of course. But you can see that. You can look back in history, in fairly recent history, and you can see how certain religions do quite patently, historically, get originated through, you know, to some weird, kooky cult leader, you know, I mean, something like Scientology or Mormonism or whatever it may be. And it's quite obvious how ridiculous it is, and yet you still have many seemingly intelligent people following along. It seems as if we like checking our brains at the door when we come to the church or the temple. And it's not at all obvious that the same thing is not the case through history as well. And it's not at all obvious that historical religions sometimes might not be founded in similarly kooky ways by eccentric or sometimes outright mad teachers whose words get then taken up, interpreted in different ways, filtered through different perspectives, added onto, corrected, and so on. And then, you know, you end up with something quite different. That was one of the classic dynamics in Chinese culture, was that after Confucius taught, then for several hundred years there evolved this school of Confucianism, which you know, was supposed to perpetuate and the works of the master and the sayings of the master. And then about 500 years after his death or so, and so this is about 100 BC or something like that, there are some dates on this, I can't remember exactly, they demolished the house, or a house where Confucius used to live. And when they knocked down the house, hidden in a niche in the walls was some ancient scrolls. And the ancient scrolls were in such old writing that they couldn't read them. And it took many years of study before they learned how to actually read the writings, and when they deciphered them, they found they were the actual writings of Confucius himself. And that was a bit unfortunate, because they disagreed quite substantially with the Confucianist teachings which were being taught at the time, which is a little bit inconvenient. Obviously Confucius needed a re-education program to teach him about what Confucianism really was. And so that caused a great clamour in Confucianist circles, and they basically split into two schools, and since then the Confucianist movement was divided into two parts based on whether the authority of these scrolls was accepted or the authority of the commentarial tradition was accepted. And so it's interesting to notice these things, you know, it's good to learn about different ways that religious and spiritual teachings happen, because so often they evolve by very chance and random events, and we come along later and read profound truths into them. And we may be correct, there may be profound truths to be read, but if we look at the origin of them, then often they're just very chance. And we were talking about this the other day, for example, the Heart Sutra starts out the very famous phrase, "Form is emptiness, emptiness is form." And actually, if you look at the evolution of that sutta and where it comes from, what it's derived from, it's almost certain that the fact that that particular phrase is at the beginning of the Heart Sutra is virtually an accident. And the Heart Sutra itself gives a whole list of different dhammas, and it's only chosen that first one because it was based on earlier texts which started with that particular dhamma of the first of the five khandhas. And if they'd started with, for example, the six sense bases, it would have said I is emptiness and the emptiness is the I. Or if they'd started with dependent origination, it would have been ignorance is emptiness and emptiness is ignorance, or something like that. And it's completely random why it started with that one, and yet somehow that becomes encapsulated as the essence of the Heart Sutra, as if this is somehow the profound message that it was supposed to be conveying, whereas actually it's just a quirk of the redaction. And so, you know, if we want to, I find these things a bit silly, really, I'll be honest. And you kind of look at the, why do people, can't we, haven't we grown up a little bit beyond this, that we can step back and say, well, hang on, you know, I don't have to believe these things anymore. We do not have to believe these things anymore. And we need to have the maturity to understand this. You know, in the past, you know, maybe we were made to believe things. Maybe if we were in Europe, we would have been hauled up before the Inquisition if we believed something wrong. Or maybe we lived in places where we simply didn't have access to information and knowledge that would allow us to question and our beliefs and so on. But those things don't apply anymore. And if we're not inquiring and testing our beliefs, then basically that's for one reason, and that's laziness. And I think a lot of people, when they come to spiritual practice in Buddhism, basically want to jettison their brain, basically because they use it too much and they can't be bothered. And I think the kind of the message is, well, I'm sorry, but it's just not good enough. We have to use our common sense, use our wisdom as best we can, and try to use that in a balanced way, in a gentle way. We're not using it to try to rubbish and dismiss and criticize others. We're using it to try to find what is the truth so that we can solve the problems of our lives. These things are very important. Dhamma is extremely important. How we choose to live the Dhamma, how we choose to embody, it is going to change the very structure of our being, of who we are. It's going to be changed by the choices we make in the Dhamma. This is going to go into, it's going to be like a hand that's going to stick itself into our guts and rip out. What's it going to rip out? Is it going to rip out our liver? Or is it going to rip out a cancer that's growing there? Yeah. Well, we want to shine some light in there and make sure we know what we're doing. We rip out the right thing, you know. And we don't rip out the liver or the stomach by mistake and then realize we've left the cancer behind. And so we need to develop these skills of inquiry and understanding and so on. And that needs to be an important preliminary before we can commit ourselves and throw our lives into some kind of teaching. And this, of course, all comes under the heading of a right view in the Noble Eightfold Path. But there also comes a time when you have to say, well, that's good enough. Where you have to say, well, I think this is what I want to do. And that doesn't come with a guarantee. It's not 100% that you're certain you know this is what you want to do. But, you know, you've given it a reasonable amount of time, a reasonable amount of effort. Now you want to put your effort into this particular avenue. So then you do that and you say, okay, I'm going to take up precepts at a certain level of training. I'm going to do this particular kind of meditation technique. I'm going to do this retreat. I'm going to study these texts. I'm going to join XYZ group. I'm prepared to abandon these beliefs that I had and operate as if, under the belief and karma, and I'm going to believe in the Buddha's teachings on impermanence and not self. They make sense. They seem real to me. I can understand how they can help my life. And so we sort of launch out into practice and we start doing what we're doing. And so once we've done that, then there are certain different kinds of problems that we encounter. And it's here that this idea of waiting becomes very crucial. And the idea of just waiting, just to be there and just not do anything. Because you're already doing what needs to be done. There are certain things that the Buddha said, okay, this is the path, and we should know what those things are. We've discussed them time and time again in the sutta classes and other things. The Buddha told us we should keep our precepts. He told us we should practice sense restraint. He told us we should do the duties we need to do in the monastery. He told us we should learn the Dhamma. He told us we should be kind to each other and generous, open-hearted, patient. He told us that we should examine our mind, abandon the defilements of anger and so on. Ill will, greed, conceit, all of those things, when we find them in the mind, we should abandon them and let them go. We should have a sense of contentment in our life, not always running around trying to get more things and so on. We should have a moderation in eating, not eating too much, not sleeping too much, not speaking, hanging around with people too much, and socializing excessively. And devoting ourselves regularly to meditation practice, and so on and so forth. So all of these kinds of things that are told, the Buddha's teaching has this positive component. It's not just a deconstructive technique, okay? It's not just a way of refuting what's wrong, but there's actually a positive component of things that we actually need to do. And we can always do, well, there are certain number of things among those things that are kind of self-limiting, okay? And you can't kind of do them anymore once you've done them. And then you if you practice non-stealing, then, oh well, you're not stealing anything, so there's not much you can more do to keep that precept. Of course, you can then flip it over to the positive and say, well, the positive side of that means giving. Okay, so that positive side you can always develop more. But on the basic side of keeping the precept, there's certainly self-limiting. Other things are not self-limiting in that way. So, for example, meditation practice, you can always do more. Okay, there's no limit on how much meditation practice you can do, except if you're going mad, in which case you should probably limit it. But generally speaking, it's always good to do more meditation. So if people ask me how much meditation should I do, the first thing I do is say, well, how much are you doing now? And if they say, well, I'm doing half an hour a day, I say, well, you should do an hour. If they say I'm doing an hour a day, I said you should do 2 hours. If they say I'm doing 2 hours, I say you should do 4 hours. And so on. And so we can always be doing some more meditation practice. And so there's that sense in which we should always be challenging ourselves and we should always be keeping an edge on the practice. I think that's really important, not to be getting complacent and stale about it. And that's why doing things that are a bit extreme are good, like, say, staying up all night and meditating, from time to time. Just deciding, okay, I'm going to learn to recite the Parimokkha, for example. That's another thing you can do, which it's a big commitment. You have to sort of go out there and commit yourself every day, again and again and again, memorizing, and so it's a large commitment of time to do something. And so there's certain things we say, well, look, I'm going to push myself, I'm going to keep a bit of edge in my practice, and you need to do that. Otherwise it gets dull, it gets blunt. But there's also a sense, a very important sense, where you have to say, well, actually I'm doing it, actually. The practice is there, you know? And it's, and ultimately, you know, if we keep on looking around for, you know, XYZ teacher, XYZ practice, XYZ technique, it ends up, it's no different from looking into a crystal ball or, you know, trying to divine the future from the entrails of a mouse or something like that. It just ends, it's a kind of sila bhatta paramasa of just attachment to the external forms of things, and that we keep thinking that somewhere, sometime, someplace, somehow we can find that thing that's going to do it to us. But they're always externals. And it's very interesting, if I reflect on this in my time as a monk, that, you know, very often you hear people say these kinds of things. Oh, you know, I'm going to have to go to such and such a place and then I can practice. I want to go to such and such a teacher and I can practice. And very rarely do you find somebody who says, I'm going to have to abandon greed, hatred and delusion, and then I can practice. Yeah? Oh, I identify this problem in myself and I don't care where I am. I don't care who's around me. I don't care what's happening. I'm going to abandon that defilement because that defilement is causing me problems. That defilement is causing me suffering. That defilement is causing other people around me suffering. And I am going to get rid of that defilement, whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. And I will not stop, I will not rest until that defilement is eradicated. So that's the kind of attitude that we need to have in our practice. What is actually important? Where is the actual defilement that are actually causing us problems, and not trying to manipulate external conditions until somehow everything's perfect. Because it isn't, it never will be. But if we are practicing the path, and we're practicing in a balanced way, we're practicing in a sustainable way, an even way, and in practicing intelligently, then the path will unfold itself and we don't have to worry about it. And so often the worry about it is nothing more than lack of faith. Nothing more than lack of faith. The path works. Keeping precepts works. Being content works. Being patient works. Studying the Dhamma works. Meditation works. All of these things work. And if we do them, that's enough. That's enough to get enlightened. Or for everybody here. Everybody has the capacity to be enlightened. The Buddha said, you know, there are certain people who cannot realize and penetrate the Dhamma in this lifetime. People who've murdered their mother, murdered their father, murdered an arahant, maliciously shed the blood of a Tathagata, caused a schism in the Sangha, or those who are mentally retarded. Okay, can't grasp and understand the Dhamma. Okay, these six kinds of people cannot get enlightened in this life. Okay, so that doesn't mean they shouldn't practice. Of course, they should still practice, and hopefully in future lives they'll be able to see the Dhamma. But if we don't fall into those six categories, then what is your excuse? What exactly is your excuse? The Dhamma is there. We are just waiting for it. Here we are, sitting in a room, surrounded by the Dhamma, swimming in it. It is our hearts, it is our blood, it is the foundations of our mind. All of these things are Dhamma. All of those things are impermanent. All of those things are suffering. All of those things are not self. All of those things are dependently originated. All of those things are empty of a self or what pertains to a self. There they go. Where do you need to find that? Where do you need to go? It's right here. Where could be more dhammic? Where could we be in contact with the Dhamma in any closer? How could we be more intimate with the Dhamma anywhere, anytime, any way? What possibly could be more intimate in our relationship with the Dhamma than what is happening right here and right now? There is nowhere, no time, no place, no person, no thing, nothing that is better than right here, right now, for practicing the Dhamma. It is all there if you want it. Just let go of all of those defilements and attachments and everything, and there, boom, there's the Eightfold Path. Enlightenment, it's all there waiting for you, just like you're waiting for it. It's almost like you're kind of drifting past each other in the park or something like that. You know, the Dhamma is there. You're kind of in the park waiting for Dhamma, Dhamma's waiting for you, but you're just too shy to say hello to it. Do you come here often? So there's that, when the mind has that sense of contentment, when all of those things have been done, we've made that decision, we put ourselves on the path, and we're moving in the path in the right way, in the balanced way, then there's that period of like the waiting and of the complete just openness to it. All of the stuff has been done. And then it's just time for the Dhamma to roll on in its own way. And it can't be forced. We're waiting for it. We're waiting for it because it's already there. Because even though it's already there, it's very shy. It's very kind of delicate. Doesn't want to show itself. It's like shy, wants to hide behind a veil. And we can't force it out from behind that veil. The more we try to force it, the more it will pull back and try to hide again. But if we just leave it and we're just comfortable, then the veil will gently pull itself back and we'll be able to see. So this is my little talk for you this evening on waiting for Dhamma. I offer this for your education and edification. And anyone got any comments or questions?
Yes. Yes, it was fantastic.
I have two questions, Bhante.
Yeah.
First of all, what sutra is it where the Buddha mentions abandoning his search for the Holy One?
I think there's a few suttas. I think it's in the Anguttara 3s, if I remember correctly. We can look it up. Yeah.
And the other one is in practicing the path in a balanced way.
Hmm.
Does the Buddha anywhere recommend how much to meditate? And also the idea of on retreats, on intensive retreats, having continuous mindfulness the whole time, all day, every day, for many days in a row. Where does that sort of come from, and is that practicing in a balanced way, or?
Okay, well, first question about how many hours per day. Well, the Buddha's basic recommendation was you come back for the monks and nuns, you go arms round, come back, finish your food, sit in meditation, walking, sitting, until nighttime, first part of the night, walking, sitting, middle part of the night, have a rest, and then the last part of the night, get up, do walking and sitting meditation, going off for arms round again. So that's like the basic recommendation.
Two-thirds of the day.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah. So, life gets in the way of that sometimes, you know, occasionally. Well, most of the time it tends to, but that's like an ideal, you know. And certainly, you know, it is possible to live like that. And, you know, for periods in the rains retreat, and, you know, if we have retreat times and so on, then we can, you know, pretty much do that for extended periods, which is a great opportunity. So, the most I've ever heard anyone, I heard one monk who would meditate, he would sit meditation 3 times a day, but each time he would sit for about 6 hours. So that's pretty good. As far as the idea of the retreat goes and the constant mindfulness, I mean, of course, okay, there's a number of issues there, but one, I mean, historically the idea of the intensive retreat as such was developed by the Burmese in the last century, okay, so there's no real records of that existing, certainly in the Theravada tradition earlier than that. I think in the Zen tradition they may have had something similar to that. The idea, of course, of practicing with mindfulness during the day is of course a very fundamental part of Buddhism, but there's a slight shift in the emphasis on what that mindfulness is. Not a complete change, but maybe a slight shift in the emphasis. If you go to the classical Vipassana retreat or something like that, say Mahasi retreat, that what they emphasize on mindfulness is being aware of exactly where your body postures are at any one time. That's really the main emphasis, you know, am I walking, am I standing, this particular arm is here. And so it's that particular aspect of mindfulness which you're trying to maintain throughout the whole day. And of course, if you can do that, that's fantastic. You know, that's a very good training of the mind, and that's one of the reasons why doing those kinds of retreats, you can get, you know, very good concentration and very good insight in a short amount of time. The problem with that practice is not the practice itself, but that if you look at the way the suttas talk about what we call today mindfulness in daily life, it doesn't really emphasize so much on that sort of physical knowing where things are. Well, that's part of it. It's not a different thing, but that's not so much the emphasis. The more the emphasis is having like a contextual awareness of what you're doing. Okay, so this is what we call sampajanya. Okay, so the difference between these two things is what I learnt at the end of my first meditation retreat. and I've told this story many times before, but this was, finished the retreat, right? I was very determined. I'm just going to keep mindful all the time. I'm not going to let it wander. We were asked to do some work. First time I'd ever done any work after meditation retreat. Right, I'm going to stay mindful. The job was retrieving a few bits of wood from a demolished kuti. We were asked to help out, salvaging some wood. And I come up to the building side, and I'm like, right, mindful, foot coming up, foot going over, foot going down onto a rusty nail. First step, straight onto a rusty nail. Perfectly mindful. I knew exactly where it was. That foot is there. It's going down right there. There's the nail. There's me screaming. And it's perfectly mindful. And then you begin to think, oh, this kind of mindfulness bit's got maybe a bit more to it than that. Yeah? And so that's the difference between what we call sati and sampajanya, if you like to put it in that way, mindfulness and clear comprehension. The mindfulness knows exactly what's going on. The clear comprehension is a bit more contextual. It understands stuff, yeah? And so, okay, this clear comprehension is actually, you know, in your mind saying, you're just wearing a thin pair of thongs and you're about to step onto a building site, you know, be careful of where you're stepping, yeah? And mindfulness just knows where the foot is, yeah? So this is something, in my experience, that I think that it's a bit misleading, because I think that when people learn meditation in those kinds of techniques, those kinds of practices, you know, they learn a practice which is very good in that context. But then when you come outside and you try to apply it, of course it's very difficult, and I think there's a lot of confusion about that. And people think that somehow they should be applying mindfulness in the same way, working in an office, as they were on an intensive retreat. And then they think there's some problem because they can't. Yeah. So for example, I had like one woman who was a supporter in Malaysia, and she came up, she was a teacher. And she said, oh, this is kind of problems at work, because people come up and talk to her and they want to be friendly, and she's trying to be mindful. And you know, they get upset with her because she's just trying to be mindful. And so, well, that's not right mindfulness at that time. Right mindfulness at that time is to understand, well, there is this context where we have to work together with these other people, and I have to use my speech to try to maintain friendly relationships and so on and so forth. So right mindfulness at that time is not, you know, mindful being aware of your bodily postures or something so much. Yeah. So I think this is really the thing that we have to learn in our daily life. Is to balance that sense of sampajanya, I think, is also very important. Yeah, knowing what are you doing? What's the context? Why am I doing this?
So it's more like being present.
Yeah.
So the ideal way to practice the path is not necessarily being on retreat the whole time.
Well, for some people, maybe. But it's pretty difficult to do. I mean, a retreat is a very specialized context. You know, practically speaking, you know, basically no one does it, and there's nobody who just stays on retreat the whole of their life. You know, maybe you can stay on retreat for a lot of it. Some people have managed to do that. But for most of us, you know, there's a period on retreat and a period off, and you get into that rhythm of things. Yeah.
With the defilements, is it best to treat them like opponents and address the one that's the most threat to you, or does the Buddha recommend a systematic way of actually addressing them in order?
Yeah, best to yes, there is in a sense a systematic way of addressing it, but that systematic way is geared to addressing those ones which are of the most problem, okay, the most urgent problem. So I don't think there's really a difference between those two things. Actually, we should address, you know, whatever defilement is arising, and whatever defilement is causing us trouble, and that's the one we need to cope with. And typically, those things, I mean, in terms of the details, of course it changes, but in terms of the big picture, they typically follow a certain kind of pattern. So there's certain kind of coarser defilements which tend to, you know, obsess the mind more at the beginning, and then gradually you can overcome them, and then there's more moderate defilements and so on. So that's expressed in a number of different ways. So for example, it might be the first kinds of defilements are the defilements of body and speech. Okay, they express themselves through body and speech, and so we counteract them through keeping our precepts. And once we've kept our precept of not lying, then we can even expand that and try to keep, you know, using our speech in a really positive way for helping people and so on. And so that's sort of working with defilements on that level. And then kind of more subtle level is working with the defilements, say, on an emotional level. You know, maybe we're not speaking out of anger anymore, but we still feel the anger boiling up inside us. Yeah, and so then we work with that one, and gradually learn to calm that down and so on. And then on a meditation level, you know, it's not even just the overwhelming emotions anymore, but it's just those very kind of subtle movements and shades and shifts of the mind that you're working with. Yeah. But I think it is also important that although Dhamma has this quality, this kind of holographic quality, where on the one hand it's progressive, but on the other hand it's also simultaneous. And so in a sense, you know, yes, you do work in a progressive way with defilements, but actually the coarse defilements are still there even when you're working with the subtle ones, but they're maybe not so obvious. I noticed that when I was in Thailand, I was staying at Ajahn Dunn's monastery, and you know, we did chores time. We did two kinds of chores, and the first one we had to sweep the paths, and there's quite broad paths, and they had these special brooms that were made for the Western monks there, which are like really big and long and tall. And so you could get these huge broom things, and you're sweeping in these big grand gestures right across the path. And so, and it's like a, you know, it's like a road. So you're just sort of walking from one end of the road, so it's really physical, and you're getting really sweaty and raising huge amounts of dust, getting rid of all the leaves. And then after that, I used to clean the shrine. And in the shrine at Ajahn Dunn's, it's very, very subtle. They've got a whole basket full of different kinds of feather dusters, all marked and labelled for cleaning different kinds of things. So one of them is marked for cleaning the pictures, or for cleaning the Buddha's disciples who are sitting there. Another one for cleaning the Buddha's head. Another one, special one marked, it says Gon Pra, which means the Buddha's bottom. And so it's one of special feather duster for wiping the Buddha's bottom. And it was, and you kind of realise that kind of thing, that, you know, those feather dusters, you know, you did a really nice job of cleaning the shrine with those, but of course you wouldn't use the same for cleaning the leaves up, and the same thing, you wouldn't use the big brooms for cleaning the shrine. So they're both complementary. I did a double take on this when I was asked to do this, and I was looking at this thing, and there's all these different labels, and there's one that says Gon Pra. I said, oh, sorry.
Ajahn, I have one question.
Yeah.
That is on the Buddha says that we have mental suffering and physical suffering,
mm-hmm.
and physical suffering itself, there is avoidable physical suffering and not avoidable physical suffering. So my question is on the non-avoidable physical suffering.
Hmm.
How to better understand that towards having a clear understanding of the body being non-self? Because,
mm-hmm.
for example, if I were to play a sport, and I trip and sprain my ankle, so I definitely feel the suffering.
Yeah.
How do I relate that incident to the understanding of non-self in terms of the body?
Yeah. Well, that's a very good question, because those things are very intimately related. And it's one that the Buddha talked about in his second discourse, Anattalakkhana Sutta, you know, because it brings affliction, the body brings affliction. And some things, some things you can fix, some things you can't. And you can't control that. You can't sort of decree in your mind, let it be without this kind of pain. Yeah. And so this is an important, very important principle. It's very subtle. But there's just this idea or this understanding that if something was a self, then we can do what we like with it. So we just think, you know, like this home, this house is ourselves, and within limits we can do what we like with it. We can paint it a different colour and whatever. But if I think of this body as myself, well, I can't paint it a different colour. I can't think, well, I'd like to be yellow today and paint it a different colour. Because you can do those kinds of things. You can do cosmetic surgery and so on. But you can't just do it by an act of will. Yeah? So pain is a very good teacher in that kind of, in that sense, because it drives that message home, yeah, and it doesn't let you escape from it. You know, like with all your will, with all your might, you would wish to be relieved from that pain, yeah. If you had any choice at all, of course you would choose, you know, to be without that pain, and yet you can't, yeah. And so it almost like the pain itself is almost like a wedge, which separates, yeah, your sense of self or sense of identity from the body. It forces you to say, I can't be this body. Like, what I'm thinking of me, it can't be the same as this body. And so, at that level of practice, you know, this is something that I think that underlies a lot of religious and spiritual practices in a subtle way, a realization that the body is full of affliction and is going to die, and so then immediately we're sort of forced apart from that. And then we seek for something else. Oh, if I'm not my body, I must be something else. Maybe my feelings, or I'm my thoughts, I am my memories, I am whatever it may be. So we tend to look at mental things and identify with that. So that then takes, the practice goes onto a more subtle level, and we have to investigate those things as well. But that initial understanding of the pain and almost like the despair which is inherent in physical pain, that's very useful, because it's very primal, yeah? It relates to a very primal sense of ourselves as being our body, and sometimes you need a good jolt to shove yourself out of that. And you see that happens a lot of time, you know, if you ask people about where their spiritual practice came from, a lot of times it comes from people becoming ill, or family members becoming sick, or people passing away, or some kind of big shock like that, physical shock, and that's what, you know, makes people realize, oh, I'm not my body, and then start to looking for something.
Buddha often spoke about diligence, particularly to his bhikkhus. And at one point, I think there were three bhikkhus, if I remember correctly, and Buddha asked them, given a certain amount of time, how soon do you think you should try to realize Dhamma before your body, before you pass away?
Mm.
And I think the first bhikkhu said, well, I need to, I don't remember the exact sequence or the time frames, but I think the first bhikkhu said something like, well, I need to come to realization within a day, because I might be dead tomorrow. And the next bhikkhu said, I need to come to realization within the next hour. And maybe it was the next minute. And the third bhikkhu said, I need to come to realization before my next breath.
Yeah.
And the Buddha said, sadhu, 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 to the third one.
Yeah.
So he has another simile where he said we should practice like our hair is on fire.
Yeah.
So...
Why the monks are shaved, because he...
Yeah.
Don't worry about it then.
So, I mean, but I mean, if you listen to this, if you try to understand the simile, what he's meaning is that we should feel a tremendous sense of urgency, not knowing when we might die.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I'm wondering is how you are able to reconcile this with the idea of waiting.
Mm.
And what is the thin red line between patience and complacency?
Yeah.
Because people oftentimes, I know sometimes it happens with people, even bhikkhus sometimes, after a period of time, they lose that sense of urgency that maybe they had in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking I'm speaking also in terms of my own situation sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if we don't have that sense of urgency, then it's really hard to put forth the energy that's required.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering how you would see this situation. And how we can reconcile these two, and how we can discriminate between what is patience, what is the willingness to wait,
yeah,
and what is complacency.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I guess there's no clear cut answers, but one practical answer would be, I guess in part that you just know through reflection. So I'm being honest with yourself, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not sure, then I think that's why I think also kind of I mentioned about the just putting yourself on the edge sometimes, you know, and testing yourself, and then that then makes the difference. Then you kind of know, oh, hang on, you know, I think if you know, if your practice is going well. And so on. Then, if you do those things and put yourself on the edge and push yourself in certain regards, then you kind of realize, well, yeah, that's kind of okay, but you know, it doesn't really change anything much, you know. Whereas if you have been very complacent or very lazy, then sometimes that forces you to be honest to yourself, you know. Just doing things like staying up all night, for example, you know, in those kind of dark hours in the early morning, you know, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, yeah. It's, yeah. It's kind of gets pretty real at that time, you know. You kind of can't. Your layers of self defences and self justifications get exhausted, you know. And you're just there. So I don't. Yeah, it's one of those things. I don't think there's a hard and fast answer. But this is, of course, this is why, you know, ideally if you have a Buddha around, then he knows, doesn't he? And he knows this bhikkhu needs firing up and this one needs calming down, and so he gives him the right one. But we have to find the balance for ourselves.
Somehow I always remember that remark when all these disciples got together, and how you could lighten what was the name of the forest when they were all talking about how they...
Gosinga Sutta, Mahagosinga Sutta.
Yeah,
yeah. Gosinga, yeah.
Yeah, and then finally you come to the Buddha.
Yeah, right, right.
And then you think, oh my God, how could I do this? How could I practice like the Buddha? But yet he's our mentor. He's our example. He's our lodestar.
Yeah.
He's the one we should, you know, set our sights by.
Yeah, yeah.
We should try to emulate him if we can.
Yeah.
And yet, maybe only a Buddha could practice in that way. There seem to be some individuals,
yeah,
that have that tremendous drive, that tremendous sense of urgency, that they're willing to just lay down their life,
yeah,
if need be.
Yeah.
So sometimes I feel maybe even a little guilty that I'm kind of just kind of toddling along.
That's venerable. That's just your Jewish heritage catching up for you. Just a self-hating Jew, you know. Yeah, but I think you know, this is the Buddha. He just pulled it out of the hat, wouldn't he? You know,
right.
Just when you think that, like in that Mahagosinga Sutta, they've all said something really beautiful, and the Buddha pulls something out of the hat that turns it into a whole other dimension. You know, this is his skill. I didn't mean that about that kind of Jewish thing.
Yeah.
So did the Buddha ever talk about being attached to Dharma itself?
Being attached to Dharma?
Concepts or like ideas about Dharma?
We were talking about that the other night. And the sutta class the other day about the Dhamma Ragena, there's a kind of one passage where it says, you know, you become an you become an anagami because of the dhamma ragena, the love for dhamma, but it's not clear from the passage whether it means that you're kind of limited to being an anagami and you can't become an arahant because you're still attached to dhamma, or whether it means that you actually do get that far as being an anagami because of your love for dhamma. So I guess that's probably an irresolvable ambiguity. It's probably quite a nice ambiguity that you know. I think the attachment to dhamma, certainly there's a passage where it talks about that you sometimes can't find peace of mind in your meditation because of thinking about dhamma, yeah. And so that's pretty straightforward. Yeah, if you can't, you know, thinking about dhamma is good, but you need to be able to stop thinking about dhamma and go into the peace of meditation as well. So that's certainly true. And it's certainly the case that we are attached to our ideas about dhamma, and then that can be a disturbance and an emotional problem, you know, and you can, of course, get very het up, and people can argue about it, you know, have very hot arguments about meditation and particular dhamma interpretations and so on. But it's certainly not a major theme, you know, in the Buddha's teachings, you know. The main things we're attached to is actually all the non-dharma things. Trent?
Just going back to what you were saying before about dissecting dharma and the phrase where, what did you say? Something is emptiness and emptiness is something, and that was...
Form is emptiness, emptiness is form, yeah.
I wonder, I can't remember what sutta it was in, but the Buddha says that the dharma is like a sight, like the words are the dharma, but they point towards
mm-hmm.
reality or truth.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I wonder, there's also a book called the... set of motorcycle maintenance,
mm-hmm.
where they talk about once you dissect something, it ceases being what it was
mm-hmm.
in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so, was that the message that you're saying, that you, when you read the
mm-hmm.
sutras,
mm-hmm.
and you take the message and not so much pay attention to the detail?
Not really. I can't remember now what point I was trying to make it. I'm sure it was a really good point. Obviously we shouldn't be hung up on the forms of the letter of the Dhamma, and that's basically what the Heart Sutra is saying, is that it's pointing towards enlightenment, and it's not getting hung up on the details. So that's all good stuff. But you know, the flip side of that is you know, the counter problem again, which is the other extreme, is to simply throw out all the details. Yeah, and so this is another problem, and I think that's largely just intellectual laziness. That people just can't be bothered paying attention to actually working out the Dhamma and trying to nut out. Sometimes you have to do it. You're going to nut out thorny problems and interpretations and things, and that's a part of the mind as well. And I think this is kind of a part of the problem, I think, in Buddhism, in Western Buddhism, is it's kind of emerged from this post-hippie kind of thing, which is very anti-intellectual and kind of rejecting of text and authority and these kinds of things. And so we think that there's something clever about not knowing what we're talking about, and just feeling our way into it. And so if you feel it, you know, and emote it painfully enough, then it's real. Yeah, it's real because I emote it, you know, and it's called the narcissism of feelings, is what Ken Wilber calls it. And I think there's something very true about that. But the reality is that part of our mind is also intellectual. Part of our mind is using our intelligence, and that part of our mind also has to get enlightened. Yeah, that's not to say that's the whole of our mind. So fair enough, that's not the whole of it. It's not the best part of our mind. It's not itself pure enlightenment. It's not going to solve all of our problems, but it is part of it. And if we ignore that, it's just another kind of denial. Yeah, it's trying to pretend that spiritual practice doesn't happen in that section of our brain. You know, well, no, that's not the case. That's a certain part of our mind, and certain kinds of problems can be solved there, and certain kinds of understanding and wisdom and so on can arise through using that in the right way. So that needs to be part of our practice.
So can the same thing be said about various rituals and you know, those forms also, mm-hmm. like external forms? Is it just you find the form that you're comfortable with,
yeah.
in practice,
yeah.
or that is most beneficial to you? Or do you have to take on, you know, do you have to walk into an entire established form?
Yeah, well, that's also, I mean, that's also a kind of a post-hippie question, isn't it? Can you, even to be able to ask that question, can you take up the bits of a form? Like, if you're born into a traditional culture, that question couldn't even arise. You're in there, you know, this is what we do, this is what mum and dad did, this is what their mum and dad did, and that's what, and they kind of evolve very, so we, even to have that choice is already very distinctive of our culture.
It's also a function of globalization.
Globalization and so on, yeah. So, I mean, in the sense of the externals of the form, I think probably don't matter too much. I think it is good to have a certain degree of those kinds of things, you know. And so we still, you know, you have some bowing and you have a Buddha Rupa, and there's some people want to sort of rationalize it completely and get rid of all the Buddha images and stuff like that, and to me that's a bit unnecessary. And I think it probably doesn't matter too much whether the Buddha image that you bow to has a Thai-looking face or a Tibetan-looking face. I mean, to me, I don't think one of those other is not going to make you get enlightened or not get enlightened. So, but there is something about the integrity of a particular form or a tradition. And one of the important things about ritual is that it's something everybody does together. So when we bow together. Yeah, so it creates a sense of community. And you're going to feel that. It's quite interesting to notice that. They say, you know, when we do stuff, you know, maybe, you know, we have people who come along to a talk or something who maybe don't feel comfortable bowing, and we always say, oh, you know, if you don't feel comfortable bowing, there's no need to. But they're always not quite comfortable not bowing as well, and you can kind of feel that because you're not entering into that community and there's a sense of reservation about it, yeah? So it's kind of interesting.
This just came up with the two children here earlier because I mean, my son is familiar with certain things now, but his friend is not at all, and we drove in the driveway and he went, it's just a house.
Mm.
And I said, what were you expecting? Mm. I don't know, something like in Wollongong, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, oh yeah, maybe that's a bit different there. Well,
give us a few years.
Yeah. And then, you know, we came up here and just showing him a few different things, and I said, well, you know, usually, you know, people bow three times to the Buddha to say thank you for the teaching. But it was really interesting for me to describe to the 12-year-old what I chose to do, you know.
Right.
Because he was coming from a completely alien kind of perspective.
Well, 12-year-olds are aliens.
But it sets, of course, you questioning why you're doing anything at all.
Yeah. Okay, let's finish up by paying respect.